When you start investing in stocks, you seek investment advice. When you seek investment advice, you go to the internet. When you go to the internet, you start believing all the wacky correlations spouted by armchair analysts.
Sell, 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 sell.
When you start believing those wacky correlations, you start buying and selling stocks based on butter production in Bangladesh. When you start buying and selling stocks based on butter production in Bangladesh, you offend your lactose intolerant girlfriend, who in turn moves out. When your girlfriend moves out, you can't afford rent on your own because all your money is tied up in the stock market. When you can't afford rent on your own, you become homeless and alone.
Thank you.
Don't become homeless and alone. Get rid of financial advice from armchair analysts and upgrade to Money Talks.
This is Money Talks.
We're back. Come on, Roger. That's pretty good, right?
Not bad. Not bad. I've never heard that before.
Oh, I'm Bill Lako with Troy Harmon and Dr. Roger Tutterow, Kennesaw State Economics Professor, our Chief Economics Advisor. And
We got quite a few questions this week, and anybody that has a question can get them answered online if you give us a call at 770-429-9166 is our direct line. You can talk to a person there. If you'd like to use our question hotline, you can call 1-855-429-9166. Leave a message. We'll play your recorded question on the air and then answer right behind it. You can also email us, drgene@hensler.com. That's H-E-N-S-S-L-E-R.com. You can also find us on various versions of social media. We have a Twitter page, LinkedIn, Facebook. Bill, Facebook. Yeah. We got them all.
Yeah. I don't do any of it, so.
Yeah. Well, all right, we got sure an we awesome marketing department. They take care of all this.
Let's take a question, because this is actually a question that came up yesterday. I was driving around looking at 6 apartment complexes with a partner they manage, 6,000 doors, so they're significantly bigger than we are, and this was the question. So Frederick from Norcross actually asked a good one. I've been reading about the Federal Reserve reducing their balance sheet. The way we're being told is that the Fed will allow the bonds that they bought during quantitative easing to mature. So what happens to the cash that they receive at maturity?
Well, here's the way to think about it. Prior to the financial crisis, the Fed executed monetary policy by targeting short-term interest rates. Mm-hmm. Then during the financial crisis, they shifted from short-term rates to long-term rates, what's called Operation Twist, buying these long-term bonds. They started buying mortgage-backed securities. With quantitative easing, they just bought bonds without explicit tying to interest rate targets. So what they're going to do now is that until recently, their position has been that any coupon payments they got on bonds they owned or any bonds that matured, they plowed that back into new securities. So they kept the size of the balance sheet the same. And now what's going to happen is they're in the process of announcing how they're going to reverse those years of accommodative policy. And so they will probably start by not reinvesting bonds that mature, not really reinvesting coupons. And so when they do that, the owner of the bond that matures, instead of those funds being taken to buy another bond, those funds come into the Fed to essentially disappear off bank balance sheets. Here's the thing to remember about the Fed. What they do is they don't actually directly control the money supply. They control the position of member banks in terms of how much reserves they have. And then it's the process of those banks accepting deposits and creating loans that creates the money supply. So to put it in reference, if you look at the monetary base, which is the reserve position of all the banks out there, plus currency held by the non-bank public, it goes from being about $830 billion to about $3.85 billion, or a jump of about 364% between late 2007
trillion,
and
right?
I'm sorry, trillion. Thank you, trillion. Yeah. A jump of 3.64% between the beginning of the crisis and date. It's going to take them
forever.
Years and years to pare that back down.
Right.
So step one is to stop the reinvesting, and then they're going to eventually start talking about how do we gradually sell some of those bonds off.
So if I'm Bank of America, whatever the reserve requirement is, I have to hold. Just make it up. 10%.
It is 10%.
Okay.
Yes.
So that, hey, I'm not as dumb as I look.
How about that?
I got a face for radio.
There you go.
So, so whatever. If they're a $1 trillion bank, they got to hold 10%.
Yeah, they have to hold 10% of their what we call transactional deposits or checking account liabilities on hand as reserves, if you will. And so because they only have to hold 10% of that, when someone deposits $1,000 in the bank, they've got to hold 10% of the $1,000, which would be $100. They can loan out the other $900. And so what ends up being the case is that when the Fed buys all these bonds through what they call open market transactions, the banks find themselves with lots of reserves. They don't make a lot on reserves, so they instead create loans with them. And so it works its way through the commercial banking system, and we get a multiple of the initial injection of reserves as a change in the money supply. Now, one of the reasons we did not see the monetary policy of 2008 and 2010 be as inflationary as it might have been expected is that the money multiplier, the number of times those funds turn over, it dropped significantly.
Right.
And so it also
banks weren't making loans.
That's right.
Right.
They were carrying excess reserves. People were carrying cash. And those both of those things are drains in,
right,
the money supply creation process.
But so, and I'm not trying to be completely stupid. Again, I went to public school, so when the bond matures, literally the Fed's just going to make the money disappear.
Right. I mean, understand that, you know, we always need to draw that distinction between currency and money. I mean, and you know, checkable deposits are money, and so what will happen is when the bond matures, the Fed will, there'll no longer be an entry somewhere in the commercial banking system for those funds. The way to do it is think about how they created money. The way they create it is the Fed goes and they buy a bond from Bill Lako, and Bill deposits those funds in his checking account.
Right.
And so all of a sudden there's an injection of that amount in, right, the commercial banking system. We're just going to unwind that now.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is the money supply increased by sixfold and thereabouts over the period from 2008 until today?
Well, no, monetary base increased by 360%, but the money multiplier actually dropped from being about the M1 money multiplier 1.6 down at one time to 0.7. So what you realize is, wow, you know, the money multiplier got whacked by, I have to do the math real quick, but that's not half, but it's a little bit more than half.
Right.
And so that there went a lot of that excess creation of monetary base. Now, eventually, you know, we will need to drain that base off or it could be problems down the road.
So, you know, I guess the part of the conversation we were having yesterday was how fast are rates really going to go up when they start letting this thing run off. And my attitude was similar to yours, although you're not saying interest rates are going one way or the other. That's going to take them forever to get out of these positions. They're not going to crush the market.
Right. Well, you know, I think estimates are all over the board on what the implications of the unwinding will be for long-term rates. I think it will push up long-term rates, but I think you're not looking at a 3 or 4% jump in the 10-year bond. You're looking at smaller magnitudes and something that's going to be stretched out over a long period of time. Now, if we did have inflationary pressures building out there, and if we started seeing the CPI rising 3 and 4 and 5%, then I think there'd be more pressure on the Fed to retract the liquidity faster.
So as part of – where is money supply at now? Has it gotten back to – I mean, are we – is part of why they were running the reserves off similar to I mean, are the banks – I guess what I'm asking, are the banks lending more now,
you know,
or is it still pretty
– Oh, no, they still are. I mean, there are some indications that they're tightening up on some construction-related credits, particularly in the multifamily housing market right now. But in general, if you talk to most bankers, they will tell you that they're still a little bit disappointed in loan demand.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the underwriting standards in general are a little bit tighter than they were before the financial crisis.
Yeah.
And one of the hopers, if you talk to any banker, one of the hopes they have is that we'll see parts of the Dodd-Frank Act roll back so they feel like the regulatory burden upon them extending credit is diminished somewhat.
Right.
Do you see that happening?
I think you will. Again, the big banks, they want to see the Volcker Amendment pull back so they can trade on their proprietary books. The more community-oriented banks are more worried about some of the CFPB actions.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think you'll see changes. It happens in every financial crisis. With pendulum swings a little bit too far toward regulation, and then afterwards we moderate some.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you think about exactly how that happened, though, it was a change in the credit quality, and that was regulated.
Yeah.
You know,
no, absolutely.
By the government
too
allow.
Happy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Roger, we were talking at the break about the impact that these low interest rates really have had, not just on the economy, but I think the psyche and ultimately what it's doing long term to businesses. So you were talking about life insurance or just insurance companies in general. Maybe you can explain how this really does hurt them.
Well, you know, Troy and I've had an ongoing dialogue for a couple of years now about in the wealth management business. As people have cash they need in the near term, typically you move them to fixed income, it's hard to get a whole lot of yield right now.
That's true. If you want safety.
That's right. And the other problem is in the insurance industry, there's two principles in insurance, reserves and mutuality. And so mutuality is when you have a loss, and I don't have one, they kind of zero out. But really, why Warren Buffett owns insurance companies is the float, the right. reserves. And it's been very hard for the insurance companies to generate the kinds of returns on their portfolios for the past 8 or 9 years. And so it puts a lot more pressure on their margins. And so I think certainly the insurers will ultimately end up welcoming seeing rates come back up
sure.
simply because they can generate more return on their
right.
on the reserves.
Yeah, when they sell annuities at certain guaranteed levels, it's difficult to draw somebody's attention when you're telling them you can give them 2%.
Right.
You get a normalization of the curve.
Well, that's not how they sell it, though. See that fine print down there where it says guaranteed. They don't really talk about that now.
Well, and the other consequence is when you look at pension programs. I mean, if we're in a very low interest rate environment, and you think going forward
Absolutely.
It's going to be hard to generate a big return,
sure.
it makes the pension plans look more underfunded.
Right.
So so if you follow that theory, and so that forces people. The Fed sort of has forced people to buy riskier assets.
Right.
Okay. So you look at the stock market, all-time high or close to it. Who knows what today or tomorrow or the next day will bring, but
sure.
we're up there pretty high. I get earnings are good.
They've been decent, yeah.
Yeah, and you could say we're certainly not at dot-com levels
in terms of
P.E. ratios, that kind of thing, but it does feel a little frothy.
Yeah.
And
where
are you going to go? Like, that's my question. I always say, I'll take some off the table, pay taxes. And then what am I going to buy? A 10-year bond paying 2.3%?
Yeah, that hardly covers inflation. You're right. not going to expand your purchasing power for sure.
And I think the Fed was pretty honest early in quantitative easing that part of their desire was to encourage people to take a little bit more risk, to get the risk on trades going.
Right.
And to kind of roll the clock back, Bill, we did the show back in the late 1990s,
right.
I believe.
Right.
And at that time, one of the models in vogue was a so-called Fed model, which
right.
tied the price-earnings ratio
yep.
to the 10-year bond. Well, we're sitting here today at 230 on a 10-year bond, so certainly you can justify a higher P.E. ratio at 230 on the 10-year
right.
than you could at 550.
Sure.
Yeah.
So.
No,
one thing that we've noticed, I mean, even this week, you look at the 2-year Treasury rate, it fell by 5.4 basis points. We look at the spread between the 2 and the 10 quite often. The 10-year fell 1 basis point, 0.01%. But you look further out, the 30-year Treasury actually was the only thing that rose. So we get a little bit of a reshaping of the yield curve. It's probably, who knows why it happened this week, but isn't that one of the fears of this unwind of the Fed's balance sheet, that the long-term interest rate, which in their buying, it was their intention to lower that long-term rate.
It was. And we have, and you mentioned the 210 spread, which is
right.
sometimes a proxy for how steep the yield curve is.
Sure.
And sometimes a proxy for how banks are going to perform in terms of net interest margin.
Correct.
It's pretty narrow. So hopefully what will happen is as the Fed unwinds their bond portfolio, we may see some steepening of the yield curve,
right.
which the bankers would welcome. And the other part of the pie is that flat yield curves typically tend to pre-tail softer economic activity down
mm-hmm.
the road. In fact, the spread between short-term and long-term bonds is one of the 10 components of the leading economic index that the Conference Board puts out.
All right, yeah. So that leads me to my question. So as I understand this statistic, and I'm going to pretend like I'm correct because I may not be, there's only been one 10-year expansion in the country?
I think since in the post-World War II era, this is the third time we've done 96 months, which is where we are in June or July, depending when you want to start it counting, would be the third longest.
Longest.
I believe that's right.
Okay. And so the longest was right at 10 years, right?
Yeah. Well, this is close. That's right. This is starting the ninth year.
Right.
We had 10 years between 1991 and 2001.
So if I believe in history, should that pre-tell something?
You know, I don't think so. And here's why. And I have this in the talks I give around the country. I make this point. I don't think that economic expansions die of old age. I think they die of bad policy.
Yeah.
They die of asset pricing bubbles. They die of inventory overbuilding. And they die of exogenous shocks and military engagements that we can't model.
One of those big words.
So yeah. Oh, you like that? Exogenous had to work yeah. that in. Okay, good.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the fact that we're 96 months in doesn't bother me. There are risks out there, and we talk about them all the time. And we started the discussion today by saying we don't see the 3.5% growth rate in the near term. We think mm-hmm. we're in a moderate growth environment.
Right.
But that certainly is different than saying that a recession's right around the corner.
Yeah, the Fed's using, what, like a 3% top end target on their Fed funds rate. I think I've seen that listed here or there. We're at 1 to 1.25.
Yeah.
This range thing is relatively new, I think. I haven't seen that before.
The range thing came in when we got down close to the zero theoretical lower bound. So they didn't want to have the Fed funds rate actually go negative. Before that, you would actually have a specific target. But if you had a 0% target, you flirt with negative occasionally. Here's the interesting part on that. You look at the dot diagrams the Fed gives you, but no disrespect to them. They're smart people, much smarter than me, but they haven't been that accurate on forecasting their own behavior.
Right.
So what I look at is the Fed funds futures markets, and the implied probabilities there have done pretty well. And right now, it called correctly the rate hike in March. It called correctly the rate hike we had in May.
Right.
And right now, you've got to go all the way to December to get an even money bet on the Fed raising rates again.
Right, yeah.
So I think most of the dialogue is going to shift to how they shrink the balance sheet. Not doing it, but talking about how they do it. And maybe we get another hike at the end of the year, but I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't wait till early next year.
Right.
So what impact do you think, if we could get Obamacare repealed or not repealed, or just getting through some of this hogwash that's going on right now in D.C., whatever side of the aisle you're on, I'm not,
right.
I personally would like to see some tax reform, but,
right.
That's just because I believe it's my money and not the government's money. But that's just a whole other conversation. So,
and part of the problem is it's hard to unwind them in isolation. I mean, I think most of the folks that understand D.C. and the way reconciliation works and all will tell you probably you've got to handle the health care issue first.
Right.
And then you can take the tax issue on, tax reform issue, and then you can take on the issue of infrastructure spending.
So it feels like it's pretty late in the year to get all this done before the end of the year.
Well, I think there's a lot of side adventures going on that maybe in part are designed to slow down the advancing of the agenda.
But I would believe that.
The corporate income tax part, there's bipartisan support for. But once we start talking about individual income taxes, out comes all the class warfare tools again.
Sure.
Right.
So, you said earlier, steepening of the yield curve helps the banks, but it does cause cost of capital to rise for all other corporations, probably them included. In fact, when you think about that, and we talked about de-risking of the economy, in a lot of ways, some of the things that our CFOs have done have decided that they would borrow at such a low rate, probably a smart thing, and then they bought their stock back.
Right.
So you go into, kind of a maturing of the cycle with companies. I sit and question, did they really de-risk? It seems to me like they've got more leverage, which is not necessarily what you think of when you're talking about less risk.
Right.
Any concerns there?
Well, there's buying your stock back out of your earnings and cash flow, and then there's buying it back by levering up, that is borrowing the money. And the concern is if the economy hits a bump on the road, if you've levered up that way, does it impact the return on equity subsequent to that? And the answer is yes, it can, of course. The other part of the pie we've got to remember on these risk-off trades is even the Treasury bonds presumably have zero default risk. And so when we talk about Treasury bond yield, long-term bond yields rising, that doesn't mean that corporate bond yields go up just as fast.
Right.
Because it could well be that the risk premium in the corporate bond market comes down. And so you might see the Treasury yields rise faster than the corporate bond yields do if the market interprets it as a positive sign for subsequent growth.
Hmm. Yeah. Janet Yellen made comments this week kind of talking about some of that. I know a lot of the bonds that they've taken on have been mortgage-backed securities. And she said that she would like to actually get down to the point where the Fed only holds treasuries. Does that impact the housing market?
Well, I think part of the attraction of the mortgage-backed securities is that it was a way of injecting liquidity directly in the housing market,
right,
which was a major catalyst of some of the downturn.
Right.
I think now that the housing market has stabilized, there's probably less of a case to be made for investing directly in that one sector as opposed to holding government debt, which presumably is agnostic with regard to sector, if you will.
Right. Yeah. Now, we swerved a little into the housing market, real estate, and that sort of thing. I noticed in the Beige Book comments this week something that I don't fully understand. Construction, this is the note, construction ranged from flat to growing. Low inventories constrained home sales in many districts. What's going on with that, Roger? You got any idea?
Sure. I would say right now the biggest constraints on the housing market are on the supply side. And there's no doubt to me we could, most markets, we could be selling more new homes if they were available. part of the problem is that we went into the recovery of the housing market with a nice inventory of lots, courtesy of failed financial institutions. But we've run through most of those in the hot segments of the economy. I mean, in metro Atlanta, you're probably talking about the northern suburbs, in the best school districts. And so as those lot inventories have come down, our banker friends are, have been funding construction loans, but there's still some gradual reluctance to fund the A&D side, the acquisition and development side. So lot inventories are low, so you can't build as many homes. It's also starting to show up as rising lot prices and home values as well.
Now, is that a pure economic decision on their part, or is that a regulatory issue?
I think both. I mean, you know, first off, the way banks are regulated now, they have restrictions on what they call their concentration ratios. So only certain percentages of your portfolio can be in commercial real estate, for example. And it's defined as the dollar amount relative to the amount of capital the bank has. There's some of that playing as well. And then also a lot of bankers, you know, went through a time they never saw in their life between 2006 and 2010.
They're scared.
And they're sort of cautious.
I mean, especially here in Georgia, that that was a huge impact. Anybody that was that seemed like they had really gone all in with development-type loans really suffered significantly. So,
did Georgia have the highest bank failures?
It had the highest number of bank failures. But, you know, if you know anything about Georgia, we got a lot of counties, we got a lot of banks, and there's a connection between the two.
All right. So, I got you.
Yeah. So when you think about these this situation, is there – I mean, we still have a few PVC farms here and there. Is that what we're talking about, or are we talking about absolute new developments that are wanting to mess with?
Great. I love that metaphor, PVC farms. And a lot of them are way out there in the extreme exurbs. You know, you can still go out very far west of Atlanta and very far east and still see them.
Yeah.
But as far as finding lots in close to 285 or in town or in the best school districts, they're pretty tough. Yeah. Now, the other artifact, and you see that right here, we happen to be sitting in Cobb County today, a lot of areas are seeing infill construction for air land that we didn't know we would ever see developed, or in some cases, gentrification of older neighborhoods. So the problem gets cleared out in several different ways.
Right.
But I don't think there's any dispute that in hot markets, it is a seller's market right now.
Yeah. All right, so we've talked a lot about what's going on in the national economy and things with the Fed. I know you generally have a pocket full of information to talk about with Georgia specifically. Anything you want to throw out about things going on in Georgia?
Yeah, you know, we're continuing to do quite well. Georgia, we felt the Great Recession disproportionate to many other states around the country. You know, we were among the 10 states that lost the most jobs. Now talk about a reversal of fortune. We've been, I think we're number 6 or 7 over the last 12 months. We're certainly in the top 6 in 2016.
But our unemployment's still a little higher than the national average, right?
Yeah, but if you look at job creation, which I think is a better way of doing it, because with unemployment, you get into those issues of if people migrate into your community, if you're a place that attracts a lot of migration, your unemployment rate's probably going to be a little bit higher.
I see.
And so historically, Georgia and metro Atlanta run higher unemployment rates than maybe what the strength of the economy would suggest. Good news on the fiscal side, we finished up the year up about 4.5% for tax revenues. That's above what the governor and the General Assembly had in the FY17 budget. So we should be able to pick up a couple bucks for the rainy day funds, which are always nice. You know, Georgia did an amazing job, I think, navigating through two deep recessions and maintaining its AAA bond ratings. And so the good news is we're gradually rebuilding the state, and we're doing so in a fiscally responsible manner.
Yeah, one of the pieces that that keeps us that AAA rate is the fact that we have a balanced budget amendment. I think we're one of like 8 states that has a AAA rating on our general obligation bonds, which is awesome. Does make bond buying a little bit difficult at times because they are so sought after. States doing decent. We've come quite a long way back. Beyond that, we do have several other questions. If you look on our list here, we've got Janet Yellen seems to be talking down the dollar. This is Kate from Alpharetta. Let's assume the Fed starts raising rates and unwinding quantitative easing. How does that affect the global economy?
Well, typically we think that higher interest rates tend to support the currency. So,
right. And I think that's probably what we saw this week. Yeah. So, you know.
You know, Chairman Yellen's, it's interesting because historically the Fed has tended to talk about interest rates most of the time and left dollar policy a dialogue to the Treasury. And Treasury tended to do the same with regard to interest rates. But there's not a hard wall there. But I do think that talking down the dollar is acknowledging that the strong dollar is hurting us on trade. It makes American-produced products more expensive on foreign markets. And so it does put some pressure on our manufacturers. And certainly, you know, we as consumers benefit from that strong dollar in terms of being able to buy foreign imports cheaper. But I think from a growth perspective, there is some risk that the strong dollar hurts us.
Yeah.
And, you know, some pretty prominent folks late in 16 said they thought that might be among the big risks for 2017.
Yeah. I noticed this this week looking at returns year to date, and, you know, we talk about it coming into this this whole show where the market's up 10% when you look at S&P 500. I noticed that the EAFE, that's Eurasia, Africa, and the Middle East, or the Far East, rather, not the Middle East, is up over 14% in the first half. How much impact do you think quantitative easing had on some of that stuff? Was that?
Yeah, you know, we weren't alone. I mean, we had an entire planet where central banks were trying to pump more liquidity in.
Right.
Because it was truly a global recession. Of course, in China's case, that means you're growing 6% as opposed to 12.
Right.
But yeah, so I think around the globe you've seen that, and that is, to some degree, that's one of the reasons the dollar has been as strong as it has, although we have been quite naughty in terms of how much monetary accommodation we pushed out there, we've had a lot of company as well.
Yeah.
And the interesting part, you know, it's been roughly 1 year since the Brexit vote. And if you watch the markets right the day before and the day after, you know, you saw, you know, of course, the pollsters had it wrong on that. But when it came out that the UK was exiting,
they had it wrong on quite a few things.
Yeah, yeah. But you saw a huge rally in the dollar and a huge rally in dollar denominated assets,
yeah,
which, you know, tells you again, in moments of crisis, the dollar's still king.
Right. Yeah. So I guess a political question to throw in the middle of this. Janet Yellen's term is up, what, in February, I believe?
Right.
Any idea? I mean, this is like a wild guess, but any idea? She's probably not going to stay on. Is that your assumption?
General assumption is that she would not be reappointed. And again, that's not a criticism of her at all. But I think there's a sense out there that President Trump will want to put his own person in, if you will.
Yeah. So does this put any pressure on her to get the unwind of quantitative easing started quicker, or I mean, is that her legacy?
I think she and Chairman Bernanke will share the legacy of quantitative easing and taking the Fed down a path it had never done before,
right,
in large part because never faced these challenges before.
Sure.
And I think it would make sense to believe that she wants to go ahead and kind of help lay out what the roadmap on a path to normalcy would be if she anticipates leaving in February.
Yeah, so is this the first time ever we've seen quantitative easing in play for any central bank or just the United States?
Well, we had Operation Twist back in 1961, where we pushed up short-term rates and lowered long-term rates. And so that's why the name got carried forward to 2011 when we resurrected that policy. But the phrase on quantitative easing, where you're really just basically saying we're going to target the volume of assets we're going to buy and talk about that less than the interest rates, that's a relatively new phenomenon. The only other experiment that might kind of line up with that at all would be what we saw in between 79 and 82, mm-hmm, the Volcker experiment,
right,
where we targeted aggregates as opposed to interest rates.
Right. Right. Final question, I guess we ought to make it quick. You see any sort of a bubble in the economy at the moment or in the stock market? I know you don't look at the stock market as much as you do the economy, but...
You know, I'm gonna leave that with you guys.
Okay.
I would tell you that, you know, as y'all commented on earlier, price earnings ratios are high by most metrics, but we're in a different kind of environment, so it'll be interesting to watch on that. And I would, though, continue to keep an eye on bonds.
All right. Well, Roger, appreciate you being here, Troy.
Yeah.
Well, we want you back again, Roger.
Always a pleasure.
All right.
Yeah. Enjoyed it.
Have a good week.
All material presented is compiled from sources believed to be reliable and current, but accuracy cannot be guaranteed. The contents are intended for general information purposes only. Information provided should not be the sole basis in making any decisions and is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified professional, such as a tax consultant, insurance advisor, or attorney. Although this material is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with respect to the subject matter, it may not apply in all situations. This is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell any financial instruments. It is not our intention to state, indicate, or imply in any manner that current or past results are indicative of future profitability or expectations. Portfolio holdings discussed are subject to change. There is no guarantee that in the future these securities will be held in Hensler accounts. As with all investments, there are associated inherent risks. Please obtain and review all financial material carefully before investing. Hensler is not licensed to offer or sell insurance products. This overview is not to be construed as an offer to purchase any insurance products.